On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraq has the world's third largest proven reserves of oil, and they're barely tapped. This week, the price of oil reached $82 a barrel, highest in history. And Alan Greenspan says in his new memoir that, at least for him, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was largely about oil. Iraq's ocean of oil is a source of endless speculation, maneuver, sectarian tension, war, and conflict inside Iraq and out over who gets what and how. The oil companies are circling. The world is thirsty. Up next, On Point, the lowdown on the oil of Iraq and its endless spillover. In a few moments, we'll talk with the former Iraqi oil minister, Issam Chalabi, and former National Security Council Mideast advisor, Flint Leverett, and more. But first, joining me from Houston is a frequent guest on our show, Amy Jaffe. She's an energy expert and fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University. Amy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Amy, ballpark, how much oil is flowing out of Iraq these days, and how does it compare to what could, should, has flowed out?
Well, we're producing out of Iraq today. The Iraqis have 1.9 million barrels a day. That's a lot lower than the 2.6 million barrels a day they were producing before the U.S.-led campaign in 2003. Potentially, you know, Iraq as an oil producer could be a 4 or 5 million barrel a day oil producer if they had a well-organized sector. So they're really suffering in terms of the revenue they could have if they could organize their sector properly.
And just remind us of the scale of the oil resource in Iraq. This is right up there with the very biggest in the world, as I understand it.
Well, yeah, they're in the top three. And I think that when you think about Iraq, you also need to remember that they're very large oil fields, and large means cheap. So whereas when we drill off the U.S. Gulf of Mexico here in the United States, maybe it's costing us, you know, $10 or $15 a barrel. In Iraq, again, if we had modern equipment and peace, you could produce oil there for something like $2 or $3 a barrel.
I'm reading here something like 115 billion barrels of proven resources in 80 fields, only 20 of those currently in production. The rest just waiting to be tapped, and even those that are being tapped, not being tapped efficiently right now. We're reading in the last couple of weeks a lot of big oil guys meeting with Iraqi officials in Dubai, circling around these resources. What's going on with, you know, the sort of contracts? Who gets what? The claims on this oil?
Well, there was Saddam very cleverly, sort of toward the end of his days, realized that maybe he could break apart the international coalition against him by trying to offer people oil contracts. So he went to the Chinese and the French and others and the Russians, but none of those contracts were ever signed. There's one contract, I think, with a Chinese company that was signed that was sort of legally binding. The rest of them were these sort of loose memorandums of understanding. So it's sort of open game, but there's still a question. I mean, if you're an average Iraqi, it was a sort of a socialist country with state-run industry for decades, and so the question of whether to open it up to private companies sharing in and producing the oil is a big controversial question there.
What is the status right now, Amy? Where oil is coming out of Iraq? Who's pumping it? Who's shipping it? Who's protecting it in the pipeline? And who's profiting from it?
Well, right now, the central government, through these divisions of regional oil companies, are producing the oil. Most of the oil that's in the Kurdish area is actually stuck because it's landlocked and it's trapped because of explosions or attacks on pipeline or crude processing facilities up there.
That is, they can't ship it out through Turkey because Turkey doesn't want them to profit from it, and they've got problems shipping it out south because they're sort of off on their own beam now and subject to sabotage.
Well, I think that, you know, probably the Turks could have been convinced to send the oil out. The problem has been that the insurgency has specifically targeted key export facilities. So there's something called crude processing. It means I have to take, when crude comes out of the ground, it has all kinds of metals and other poisonous materials in it that has to be taken out before I can sell it and refine it into gasoline. So a lot of the facilities that the Kurds needed to produce that oil have been blown up, and of course there have been attacks on the pipelines. So they are very limited in how much they can export. The rest of Iraq's oil is down by Basra, and that is the majority of the oil we see coming to market today. But even those fields that are down at Basra have been mismanaged over the years, very heavily overproduced, not a lot of good maintenance. And so those fields are themselves sort of damaged and needing more attention.
Now, the south, of course, around Basra, where these giant fields are, that's Shiite territory. Shiites now control the central government. One of the benchmarks that Washington was pushing Baghdad on for months and months now was to come to a kind of agreement on how oil revenues would be shared. That seems to have collapsed. Why?
Well, you know, unfortunately, of course, here in the United States, we think of our oil production being in Texas and Louisiana and Alaska, and those states did not know they had oil until after we'd set up a federalist system and, you know, the whole system for federal lands and state revenue and state royalties was easy to set up.
Right.
We already did it before we knew where the oil was. In Iraq, it's much more complicated. We know where the oil is. We know there's some oil in the Kurdish region. We know there's a lot of oil in the south and the Shia regions. There's a little bit of oil and gas out in Anbar. But, you know, most of the Iraqi population lives in Baghdad, and there's very little oil that's close enough to Baghdad that would count towards that population. So if I were, you know, the Sunnis, I would control a very little amount of oil if we do it on a regional basis. If I'm the people in Baghdad, I wouldn't want to agree that I don't get any tap into the oil revenue. And so it's very difficult. If it's going to be something other than we're going to distribute the oil revenue based on, you know, a per capita head census, then it could be pretty unfair in terms of who gets the revenue.
So if it's just geographically based, the Sunnis end up with a really short end of the stick here. They won't like that. Until this agreement is reached, if it's ever reached, can any of the big oil players get in there? Any of the American majors, Chevron, Exxon, you name it, or any of the big foreign majors? Are any of them in there now, or can they get in there without an internal agreement?
Well, you know, when you're going to invest billions of dollars, you don't want to be going in and investing that money under an arrangement that could be then deemed illegal by a new government, say the government were changed. So they have to be cautious. I think most of the companies are in there providing free technical advice and maybe doing some small operations of assistance and seismic or training. Because it is such a big resource and because you want to sort of, quote-unquote, be in the game. But you do have these very small companies that have signed deals up in the Kurdish region. It's very controversial as to whether or not those agreements will or won't be legal after they, quote, get an oil law together.
One of those in the spotlight recently, Hunt Oil, Ray Hunt, a member of President Bush's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, gone in for something like 100,000 barrels a day. Does that mean, Paul Krugman, New York Times, said that means President Bush knows it's never going to be a united country, or is this peanuts that Hunt can play around with, and so can the Kurds?
Well, as I joke with people, it's all well and good that Hunt has this oil field, but he's not going to be able to export it without either Turkey or the Shias. And, you know, Turkey is not going to agree to export oil from an independent Kurdistan. And the Shias are not going to agree to export Kurdish oil unless there's a national agreement. So I'd say, you know, Hunt's whistling in the wind unless there's a political settlement in Iraq. Now, some people have speculated that the Hunt deal was designed by the Kurds to scare the other parties into cooperating with making an oil law that would be more to the Kurdish liking. But again, since the Kurds are landlocked and their oil is trapped, I'm not sure how much influence signing a deal really has.
So many questions here. Amy, one thing that's been brooded about is that the U.S. companies with U.S. government help are going to try and push some disadvantageous big oil deal down the throats of Baghdad. There's a lot of talk about production sharing agreements that might not be to Baghdad's advantage, but they might have to take because there's so much instability there. Do you see the framework of an unfair deal of some kind moving toward Iraq? Is that inevitable, or is everything still up in the air?
You know, the way people do contracts really depends, or should depend, on the nature of the resources. So in the western Iraq, in the western desert and Anbar region, they should do PSA because who knows what's there. There's a lot of risk to get companies to come in and invest in a risky, geologically risky domain. You have to offer different terms. When you're talking about having a company come in and develop a resource we know is already there, PSA isn't necessary. So I think the lesson of Venezuela is that when the companies go in, if they negotiate a deal that is too attractive, they will eventually be forced to renegotiate. I mean, the Venezuelan deals were offered in 1992 when prices looked like they could be very low again. In 98, of course, we know the price of oil dropped to $8. And it was in that context that Venezuela offered very attractive commercial deals to companies like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. Well, you know, now we're 2007, and the price of oil is hovering, you know, to $80 a barrel.
No.
Venezuela is not going to accept those terms anymore.
We are joined now from Washington by Flint Leverett. He was Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council in 2002 and 2003, served for many years as a Middle East analyst and advisor in the State Department and CIA. He currently directs the Geopolitics of Energy Initiative at the New America Foundation, author of Inheriting Syria. Flint Leverett, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from Amman, Jordan, the former Iraqi oil minister Issam Chalabi. He was Iraq's oil minister from 1987 to 1990 until he was relieved of his duties with the invasion of Kuwait. First joined the oil ministry in 1967, served in many key oil-related government posts over the course of his career. He knows it inside and out. He is not related to Ahmed Chalabi, head of the Iraqi National Congress, who worked closely with the Bush administration during the invasion of Iraq. Issam Chalabi in Amman, Jordan, thank you, sir, very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
May I ask you first, Issam Chalabi, what about Alan Greenspan's recent comments quoted from his memoir that the Iraq War was largely about oil? He's gone on to say that was his view, that it was too dangerous to have Saddam Hussein that close to the Straits of Hormuz and all this oil. How are those comments resonating in your neck of the woods, in the Middle East, in Jordan, maybe in Iraq?
Well, I guess whenever people hear such comments, they would say, hey, well, I told you so. It was all about oil. I mean, particularly after Washington dismissed the possibilities of Saddam Hussein's having weapons of mass destruction or any links with Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist organization. So it had to be oil, and there's abundant quantities of oil in Iraq that made the whole situation based upon oil-related invasion.
So that may be the talk on the streets, but you've been inside the halls of power on oil and big power politics. Do you see the invasion and the war as about oil, as primarily about oil, as secondarily about oil? How do you look at the relationship?
No, I would say it was one of the major issues. I mean, certainly, I mean, it was not a secondary issue, but maybe it was not the whole issue, but it was certainly one of the major points that was in the minds of those who decided this invasion.
And what about Iraq today? Of course, there's a terrible conflict there. It makes it hard to get anything done, including shipping out oil. But should Baghdad be pushing harder to get this agreement between Shia, Sunni, and Kurds on oil? Should they be moving faster to get big oil production companies in there and get that oil and its revenues flowing?
Well, this is one thing that I'd like to comment on. I mean, I don't like to use these three words, Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds. And I'd like to think of the people living in Iraq as Iraqis. This is how we thought of ourselves. That's how we still like to think of ourselves. There were not such major differences among those groups.
We note and salute that, and we hope it returns. Yes.
Certainly. I mean, we certainly hopeful that the whole situation will come back as it was. Hmm. As far as oil, Iraq was producing and exporting almost 4 million barrels a day in 1979 when the Iraq-Iran war started. And after the war, the oil industry was also upgraded, and then about 3.5 million barrels a day were produced in 1990. So when 2003, people thought that, hey, well, we can produce as much as that, but unfortunately, the whole situation did not materialize as was hoped for, and the industry suffered lots of damages, not only because of the war, but also because lots of damages that has been inflicted by certain people, insurgents, looting, stealing. And the production now is 1.9 million barrels a day maximum. So there is a possibility. The capacity is there. And it's not a matter of dividing the oil among these three groups. And we must distinguish between something called the oil law and the revenue sharing law. We are talking about two different laws. The oil law that is being drafted by the present government, mm-hmm. it talks about how the oil industry, the upstream oil industry, to be controlled, to be run. While the oil revenue sharing is something to talk how the oil revenue, or in fact the whole revenue that is generated by a country called Iraq, is to be divided among the regions and the governorates. The two different issues. And both are not moving ahead. There are too many obstacles facing the parliament in order to start discussions on these two issues. None of these two laws had ever been put on the table for the parliament to start discussions.
We'll look more at that. Issam Chalabi, former oil minister of Iraq in Amman, Jordan, please stand by. Flint Leverett, give us a kind of strategic view here. We're going to get into the details, but what about Greenspan's comments saying this was largely about oil, at least in his mind, and where we stand today with troops and oil and interests here?
Well, I'm tempted to say that if the Iraq war was a war for oil, if you look at the state of Iraq's oil industry today, then this war was an even more incompetently planned and carried out operation than I thought it was at the time. But I think that there is an element of truth to the statement that this was a war for oil. I think that within the Bush administration, there were probably four or five reasons that important people in the administration used to justify going to war. No one in the administration believed all four or five of the reasons. The president, I think, really believed in the democracy demonstration effect argument. Mm. Many people believed the WMD argument, which was, of course, completely unfounded. I think Vice President Cheney, Secretary Rumsfeld, had no romantic illusions about spreading democracy in Iraq, but they believed there was a balance of power argument for doing this. And I think for the vice president in particular, there was an argument about oil. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, there was a lot of concern in the administration that Saudi Arabia would no longer be able to play the kind of role as a strategic partner for the United States in the region that it had played for many decades. And I think for the vice president, this was mirrored by a concern that, well, maybe Saudi Arabia won't be able to play the kind of role in the oil market that it has played for many decades as a swing producer, as a kind of leading producer with market shaping potential. And I didn't know this at the time, but I learned later that when Cheney was CEO of Halliburton, that he had had a contract for a number of years with Matt Simmons,
the guy who wrote the book Twilight in the Desert,
Saudi Arabia's getting ready to run out of oil guy. Mm-hmm. And Simmons had literally years to work on Cheney and raise doubts in Cheney's mind about Saudi oil reserves. And so I think for the vice president in particular, just as we needed to look for an alternative strategic platform in the region to Saudi Arabia, we also needed to look for an alternative market leader in terms of oil production in the region. And Iraq was the best candidate for that role. And so to that extent, I think there was a dimension in which this was a war for oil.
Let me ask you, if it was, you know, at least in significant part for oil, big picture, how or will the U.S. end up with major oil from Iraq? How will that happen? Will it happen?
It is certainly not going to happen in the way that either Vice President Cheney or, for their part, the neocons in the administration expected. The neocons believed that we could go in, and as part of their vision for reconstituting Iraq, that we could actually privatize the Iraqi oil industry. Fortunately, many of the former oil company executives who advised the Pentagon in the early days of the occupation were uniformly opposed to that. And I think it's going to be a while before Iraq is able to sort out, if it is ever able to sort out on a single national level. What are the terms with which they're willing to deal with foreign investors, with international energy companies? I think that the dominant trend in Iraqi politics is regionalist, not centralist.
Right.
And we are not going to have an oil law in the foreseeable future that will clarify these issues. I think we're going to be in for many years of governorates, regional governments in Iraq dealing with foreign investors, and we will put together over a period of years in a kind of ad hoc, informal way, we will put together a set of practices, expectations, norms that will let foreign investors very slowly, gradually, haltingly come into Iraq. But, you know, Iraq's the achievement of the kind of potential that Iraq has as an oil producer is going to be, I think, very, very slow.
Issam Chalabi, you were there as the oil minister. You know how much appetite, demand, thirst there is for this oil, and many players who would like it in Europe, in the Americas, in Asia. Do you think that Iraqi oil will end up being a major source of supply for American firms, for American consumers? Is that set in stone because American troops are there now?
Well, I agree in a way with what Clint has said, that I don't expect anything to happen in the foreseeable future. I think it's going to be a while before we see that Iraqi oil industry being redeveloped and that the production of Iraqi oil will go back to what it was before, 4 million barrels a day, and the possibility of increasing it to 6 million barrels a day. I see no problem at all with foreign companies, whether Americans or otherwise, they are being involved in developing the Iraqi oil industry. The question is how, in what form they could be involved. Amy Jaff has talked about production sharing agreements, and I think she was right. The question is, why should Iraqis give away fields that have already been discovered and they are ready for being produced? Why should they give them to foreign oil companies on basis of production sharing? While production sharing agreements, as were made way back in 1960s, were in fact modeled to suit places where risk is involved, high risk is involved. There's no risk at all when you want to develop a 1 million barrel a day like Majnoon oil field. Why should it be done on PSA?
What about the risk of being blown up? Or being...
Saddam has done that in the past. It was 100% for political reasons. He signed a contract with the Russians and the Chinese, none with the French, by the way. And he expected that those companies will have some leverage over their governments in order to break the sanctions imposed by the United Nations.
Mr. Chalabi, what about the risk, may I ask, of being shot at or bombed, the risk that comes with war? Does that justify a more generous kind of agreement with foreign investors or not?
No, it does not. I think oil is a very delicate, is a very sophisticated issue for the Iraqi people, and they would not like to go back to what the situation was before the early 70s, when there was a concession given away in 1920s to international oil companies. So I don't really see that this is happening again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join this conversation. Let me begin to take their calls. First from Dubuque, Iowa, Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, are Bush and Cheney essentially international criminals? Does one country have the right to occupy another country, have a war in order to obtain resources that they think they need?
Okay, we hear that that's still a contested premise, but some people see merit in it. Flint Leverett, how do you respond?
You know, look, I don't know what the legal status of America's invasion of Iraq is. I'm not an international lawyer, but as someone who thinks about this in terms of strategy, foreign policy, I think the Iraq War was a huge strategic blunder. It has done and will continue to do enormous damage to American interests.
Issam Chalabi, how do you see, White House American responsibility for the situation in Iraq today when it comes to oil?
Well, certainly. I mean, invasion is an invasion by foreign troops of an independent country. And there's no reason why the foreign troops should remain in this country. I think by any standard, by any international law, I mean, this is an occupation, and they have no right to decide what to do or what needs to be done. I mean, the Geneva Convention is not being respected by the Americans at all. So when it comes to oil, the Americans have no right whatsoever to issue or to push for any particular law that will decide the future of the country or the future of oil. Oil is there to be produced and to be sold to the rest of the world. Never in the history of Iraq throughout the past century, under all regimes, that oil was supposed to be kept underground. It is there to be developed and to be sold with revenue being used. The question is how this revenue ought to be used. Unfortunately, during some regimes, like the Saddam regime, a lot of that revenue was used to buy weapons and also to fund wars. But in the future, it ought to be used to rebuild the country, a country that is being completely destroyed thanks to the invasion and thanks to the sanctions before that.
Let me ask you, though, Issam Chalabi, do you think that the presence of American troops, and U.S. generals are now talking about that presence potentially going on for decades, do you think that U.S. troop presence will end up advantaging American oil firms, major firms, or not?
Well, supposedly to be so, not because of the physical presence of American troops, but because of the influence that Washington, D.C. will have over any possible government in Iraq. That's what they would do, and this is what they've been doing. They have been trying to push for an oil law that has been rejected by the majority of the people for almost 2 years now, and they have not succeeded. So I guess the presence of the troops in Iraq will mean that the American ambassador will continue to have a say in the central government or the regional governments, and that's what will happen. So the earlier that these troops will leave, the better for both America and Iraq.
Flint Leverett, what about it? Does the presence of U.S. troops put a finger on the scales there in terms of advantaging U.S. oil companies and ultimately the U.S. consumer, or not?
I actually would take a different view. I don't believe that American oil companies are advantaged by our invasion of Iraq, by our continuing occupation there. I think American influence in Iraq, notwithstanding the presence of 160,000 troops, is in decline. And frankly, in terms of positioning for major contracts down the line, it's really I really don't think it's clear that American companies are going to be in an especially advantaged position.
Flint Leverett has joined us from Washington, formerly of the National Security Council, advisor on the Middle East to the State Department and CIA, now directs the Geopolitics of Energy Initiative at the New America Foundation. From Amman, Jordan, we've been joined by Issam Chalabi. He is former Iraqi oil minister from 1987 to 1990. And I should note, Mr. Chalabi, we know it is Ramadan. You are observing that there. Fasting, no food, no coffee, no water. So we are doubly and triply grateful to you for being on with us in this
I'm enjoying it.
In this special season. We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let's go to Harvey, calling from Haddam, Connecticut. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a long-retired Foreign Service officer. 35 years ago, I was called a petroleum attaché in our embassy in Beirut. So I know a little bit about oil, but I'm out of touch. Also, I never believed anything Bush said about invading, the reasons Bush gave for invading Iraq. I think it was all about oil. But my question.
Yes, sir.
Please clarify, what kind of an oil deal or oil arrangement or oil regime, I think is the technical term, Bush is trying to impose on the Iraqis? That's my question. People talk around the edges of production sharing agreements and so forth, but I don't know what Bush is actually seeking.
Yeah, I agree. There's useful detail to be brought out there, Harvey, and I'm glad you asked that. Let us go to it. And to help us do that, let me bring in one more voice here, if I may. Also from Washington, we're joined by Nathaniel Kern, president of Foreign Reports. It's a big consulting firm providing political analysis for the oil industry, watching all this very closely. Nathaniel Kern, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Can you put this in layman's terms for us? Now, we understand there's a lot of maneuvering and tension around the oil regime that will sit over Iraq's oil. Can you describe for us what the sort of various plans in play on the table are likely to be there are? What are the big bones of contention? What are the options?
Well, I think our discussion so far has missed one point. We've talked about oil prices being touching $82. But in the past 3 or 4 years, the costs of developing oil fields, whether it's pipelines or drilling rigs or scarce technical people, have gone up by about 4 times. So the right now, a fair estimate of the cost of increasing Iraqi oil production by another 1 million barrels might be on the order of $20 or $30 billion. That's a significant portion of Iraq's total annual oil revenues. So whatever sort of petroleum regime, investment rules, or law is passed, the challenge for Iraqis will be to decide how much of their money they want to invest in increasing production, if they want to increase production, or what sort of terms they will be offering on a competitive basis to the world's major oil companies, such to attract the investment and the drilling rigs and the expertise and the knowledge that those companies are able to provide across the world.
Got it. So can you describe, in simple terms, what options they're facing here? What might be being pushed by Washington? What Iraqis may be pushing for?
Well, if I were advising the Iraqis, I'd tell them to put together a group of their experts or their parliamentarians and visit countries like Algeria or Libya or Abu Dhabi and see how those countries have managed to attract investment. Algeria has tripled its production over the past 15 years by having various sensible laws. They've changed them a bit, but they've been able to attract expertise, investment, capital into a formerly socialist-controlled oil environment. It's been a success. I wouldn't suggest they follow the Venezuelan model because I don't think that has been a success.
These models are not so well known to folks out the industry. Issam Chalabi, let me turn to you in Amman, Jordan. How would you describe the options that are being faced by Iraq now in simple layman's terms, and who's pushing for what?
Let me correct a few things that have been said by Natalie. First of all, it does not require $20 billion to increase the capacity by 1 million barrels a day. $20 billion is required to increase the capacity of production to 6 million barrels a day. This is well known. These figures have been studied carefully in the past. They have been updated recently. So $20 billion for 1 million barrels a day is something you might go to the moon for that. No. The same thing with regard to Libya. Libya's production has not been tripled at all during the past 15 years. The production has been, since I was a minister, around 1.5 to 1.7 million barrels a day and remains as it is now. They are possibly compensating for lost production from other fields. Now, what models are available for Iraq? All models can be used by Iraq. There is no sensitivity against anyone. The question is how and where to use each of those models. What are we talking about? Buyback? Are we talking about production sharing? Are we talking about service contracts? What we say as Iraqi oil experts on this subject, production sharing should only be used when there is a high risk to be taken by a foreign oil company, let it be in the desert, let it be offshore.
And you say this is because this is where the foreign oil company gets a bigger portion of the revenues.
So, as you said in the beginning of this show, you said that there are 80 fields, only 20 of them are being produced, but the rest have been discovered, and some of them are partially producing. So you need engineering companies, you need drilling companies, construction companies to carry out the work of construction. That's all you need.
In other words, hired by the Iraqi government. That would be as sort of hired hands for the government rather than sharing.
That's right. That's enough. Production sharing is certainly the model that is welcomed and required by the oil companies because they can put around let's say, between 10, 15, 20% of the reserves of that particular field in the books of this international oil company.
I see.
And this is Tom, what the Iraqis do not want to happen.
Tom, if I come in here for a minute, there are really two sets of issues that I think your audience needs to understand.
Yes, please.
One set of issues that's in play in the debate over an Iraqi national oil law is really who is going, within Iraq, who is going to have the principal say over how resources get developed and exported. Is it going to be the national government and institutions affiliated with the national government, the oil ministry, a reconstituted Iraq National Oil Company, and so on?
The famously
or is
weak
it going
national
to be,
government, yes.
Is it going to be regional governments, like in the case of the Kurds, or governorates? Iraq consists of 18 governorates. And the Constitution is to some degree ambiguous on these points, but I think by and large it actually gives a little more power and prerogative to subnational units, regions, and governorates than it does to the national government. But this is one of the major points in contention among Iraqis themselves. At what level of government should the initiative lie?
And that's
and
directly tied up with the sectarian tensions we've seen.
Exactly. So you have the Kurds being very strong regionalists. You have some important Shia parties being very strong regionalists. Sunni Arabs, by and large, are strong centralists. Certainly secular nationalists in Iraq are strong centralists. And basically, you haven't been able politically to bridge the divide on this.
So there's the internal
debate.
The
U.S. government comes down on the side of the centralists, by and large. But even the U.S. has not been able to broker a sustainable settlement on that issue. That's one reason we don't have an oil law. The other issue, and that's what you've been talking about with Mr. Chalabi, is how they are going to deal with foreign investors. And the really critical issue here, the whole point about a production sharing agreement, is that if an oil company can come in to Iraq or any other foreign company, sign a production sharing agreement, it is essentially getting an equity stake in that field. Whatever's down there, it is taking on a certain level of risk, but it is also getting a certain level of benefit in terms of equity in that field. And it is able, under American law or other, you know, internationally recognized monitoring systems, it can book those reserves.
Issam Chalabi sees this as an unnecessary giveaway because people know how much.
He's not the only person in the region who has questions about the propriety of production sharing agreements. But this is one of the other really important contentious issues. And frankly, regionalists and centralists overlap on this. The Kurds, very, very strong regionalists, but are also big proponents of production sharing agreements.
Why?
Because they want to get investors in. They want to start getting oil produced. They think it is the most efficient way to get production going in Kurdistan. On the other hand, you have some regionalists who don't want production sharing agreements, and you have centralists who are divided on this. Mr. Chalabi is a good example of someone who's questioning PSAs, but you've also had centralists in the post-Saddam period who have argued in favor of early involvement of foreign companies.
Issam Chalabi, please, where do you see this going?
I just say, now, Natalie said something. He said that the oil companies are looking for an equity because they are taking a risk. Here, full stop. I agree with that. But if there is no element of risk when it comes to finding oil, why should they be rewarded with an equity? So are we saying that for all those 80 fields in Iraq that have been discovered, alienated, okay, there is no need for production sharing agreement? You go and follow different routes.
I think we understand that, but do you see a production sharing agreement, in your view, being unfairly pushed on Iraq now? Are you confident that Iraq will have the right kind of...
What is being done, yes, because this is the intention, so it seems, by the proponents of the oil law when they are trying to put that as a possibility to be used for developing certain oil fields, even within the jurisdiction of the National Oil Company. When it comes to the Kurds are insisting that the only model to be used is for actually sharing. And this is one of the main differences between the current central government and the Kurds.
Well, I guess they would be happy to have major oil companies.
Just this.
Yes.
For their region, most of the fields have not been discovered.
Uh-huh.
So they might have a point there that the companies coming, that companies who have signed contracts 5 years ago, 4 years ago, they have not yet found an oil there. Okay, so maybe PSA is worthwhile in those areas.
Issam Chalabi, let me take a call from Sarah in Waltham, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question.
Mm.
My comment is that we heard well before the invasion from Charlie Rose that this was a war about oil coming up. And so we've known, and I have been an activist against this war from the beginning. I'm just an ordinary citizen.
Mm.
Now, my question is, I also heard recently about Chevron and Shell being involved. I wonder if that's true. Are they over there already trying to make deals, these companies, American companies? That's my question.
Let us pick it up. Nathaniel Kern.
Well, can I answer that?
All right, Minister, first to you, then Mr. Kern.
Yeah. In all fairness, no, Chevron and Shell are not there on the ground at all. There had been a memorandum of understanding with the Ministry of Oil. They've carried out from a distance a certain study concerning Majnoon oil field. So they have not signed any deal, whether it is production sharing or any kind of deal to develop oil anywhere in Iraq. They've just carried out a certain task, and that's it.
Nathaniel Kern, we've heard a lot about the meetings in the last couple of weeks in Dubai with the majors there and Iraqi officials there. What's the conversation? What's going on?
Oh, I think the major companies just want to keep their lines of communication open. They certainly aren't willing to send teams of people into Iraq at this stage because it's too dangerous.
Do you think, Nathaniel Kern, that this invasion and war will end up advantaging major American oil companies or not?
Not necessarily. There could be more adventurous companies from China that are willing to take the risks, that are more willing to take the risks than some of the major American companies.
And
I would say on the one cost issue,
yes.
I base my costs on Saudi Arabia's most recent experiences. 10 or 15 years ago, you might have been able to build things much more cheaply, but now the costs have risen very dramatically, I point out.
So have oil prices. What's your view, Nathaniel Kern, of why the markets have got oil up to $82 a barrel right now? What's the fear or the risk factor behind that?
There's a risk factor that's reflected in the commodity exchanges where paper barrels are exchanged, but also any time that the supply is very close to the demand, you can have very volatile prices. The same way, if supply exceeds demand by a considerable amount, prices can plummet down.
I've read you saying there's worry about a war with Iran in part behind these higher prices.
I think that's something that drives the commodities brokers. They're worried that down the line there might be a U.S. war with Iran, which would have drastic consequences to oil supplies in the Gulf.
Flint Leverett, do you see this situation moving, or is everything just stuck as the conflict goes on?
I think things are essentially stuck. I don't see the parliament as it is presently constituted now in Iraq being able to reach compromises on the most important issues about Iraqi oil development. And I think it's not a question of Prime Minister Maliki's leadership. It is a structural problem. You just don't have you have such fundamental divisions among the different constituencies in Iraq on these issues that the parliament can't overcome them. And I think that, in a sense, it's a reflection of Iraqi society. You know, democracy in Iraq has produced a parliament that is reflective of where Iraqi society is, and Iraqi society can't come to a consensus on these questions.
Issam Chalabi, we've just got 20 seconds, sir. How long do you think it will be before the oil is really flowing from Iraq? Years? Decades? What?
We should be talking about years, but I would say that one of the main blunders was the Constitution, because it was based on certain parameters that is not reflecting the true feelings of the Iraqi people, and everybody agrees that it ought to be amended. After the Constitution, we allowed for elections based on sectarian basis, and now we have people, we have fundamentalist religious people who are running the show in the government, in the parliament, and that is not the Iraq that we had and we are hoping to have.
Islam Talabi, with that, we're out of time. Former oil minister joining us from Amman, Jordan, we're very grateful. Nathaniel Kern with Foreign Reports, thanks to you, and Flint Leverett at the New America Foundation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.